The woman stood, gazing at the rich expanse of green above her head. Sunlight filtered through the leaves like water through a stream, illuminating the dark fruits that hung from the branches. Not far from where she stood, a serpent lay, coiled on the ground, watching her closely. Suddenly, the woman reached up and plucked a fruit from the tree. She held it in both hands and gazed at it eagerly, her mouth watering with desire. The serpent saw the hunger in her expression, and his green eyes narrowed with anticipation. However, as though sensing his impatience, the woman frowned and murmured softly, "He says that we mustn't eat it, that we mustn't even touch it, or we will die." The serpent laughed. "You will not die," he said. "He knows that when you eat the fruit, your eyes will be opened. He knows that when you taste its flesh, you will be like him." At that moment, the woman was filled with a numbness that overwhelmed her entire body. Her vision blurred so that she no longer saw the sun or the sky or even the tree. All she could see was the fruit, cupped in her hands, standing out stark and vivid from the rest of reality. "Take, eat," the serpent hissed. And the woman slowly lifted the fruit to her lips. We all know the story of Adam and Eve, how they disobeyed God, ate of the forbidden fruit, and brought death not only on themselves, but on all of humanity. Throughout the rest of the Old Testament, food remained a central motif for the holiness of God's people. Along with the great feasts and celebrations within the life of Israel, food remained an object of restriction as an extension of the original command, "You shall not eat." Alarmingly, our current society has adopted a counterfeit vision of these Old Testament dietary prohibitions. Today, we view the products of God's creation as temptations and seductions. Today, we perceive eating as a means to attain a type of self-righteous holiness. All of this raises the question, does our current society's conception of food distance us from God's redeemed order? And if so, how? We are first introduced to a distinctively Christian vision of food with the coming of Christ. Before the incarnation, as Isidore Epstein explained, dietary restrictions were, quote, expressly associated in scripture with the idea of holiness, unquote, since they set the Israelite nation apart from the rest of the world as a holy people under God. However, the dietary code was transformed by Christ through the first communion, in which he urged his disciples to take, eat. "This is my body, which is broken for you." In this way, Jesus transfigured that which was the cause of our banishment into the source of our salvation. He reassured his people that they no longer had to work to attain holiness because holiness had already been attained for them. Since then, Christianity, from within the early church of the first few centuries all the way to the medieval world and Reformation, perceived food as a reminder of mankind's membership and communion with God. In other words, that the fall had been reversed. However, by the 19th century, things began to change. Advances in technology and engineering during the Industrial Revolution allowed food to be both produced and distributed on a mass scale. All aspects of the food industry, from farming to processing to marketing, became faster and cheaper since they operated along the lines of what scholar Norman Wurzba calls, quote, an industrial logic that prized economic efficiency and monetary profitability, end quote. Unfortunately, this mechanistic perception of food came at a great cost. From the Industrial Revolution all the way to today, people, particularly the American people, have been increasingly amputated from their food, without any idea of where it comes from, what processing it has been subjected to, and who or what was affected by its production. We are losing our membership with the created order. This brings up a number of questions. For instance, what specifically are the consequences of the industrialization of food? Are there detrimental effects to our sense of what it means to be human? In short, has the modern world displaced us from a redemptive vision of eating? I'm going to argue that the modern world has exiled us from a Christian conception of food. By modern world, I mean what British sociologist Anthony Giddens refers to as the recent social and economic dynamics that reconfigure the world away from traditional values. I'm going to argue this from three vantage points. First, that a modern conception of food exiles us from creation. Second, that a modern conception of food exiles us from our bodies. And third, that a modern conception of food exiles us from biblical ethics. My first argument is that a modern conception of food exiles us from creation. In his work, The Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis observed that the fundamental difference between classical man and modern man was that classical man sought to conform his desires to nature, whereas modern man seeks to conform nature to his own desires. This phenomenon can be observed within the evolution of the major food corporation, General Mills. Though it is now one of the most dominant brands in grocery stores today, General Mills actually started out as a simple flour mill in the 1920s. However, in order to generate consumer interest, as journalist Michael Pollan observes, quote, merely preserving the fruits of nature was deemed too modest. The goal was now to improve on nature, unquote. Fast forward to today, and there is no discernible connection between this massive conglomerate corporation and the simple flour mill it once was. Similarly, there is no connection between the company's boxed commodities and the grain from which it once derived its flour. General Mills now operates in complete contrast to creation, turning what were once discernible fruits of the earth into the unrecognizable products of artificial processing. Cultural anthropologist Conrad Kotak has also noted this disconnect between food and nature. In his article entitled Rituals at McDonald's, Kotak says that fast food chains foster a sacred space similar to that of a church, complete with religious utterances such as, "How may I take your order?" and "Do you want fries with that?" Kotak argues that just as the church reorients people's minds to the world as a sacred creation, so does McDonald's reorient its customers toward food as something completely disassociated from its origins. Now, we are taught to think of a hamburger not as meat from a cow, but as a Big Mac. Similarly, we don't think of ordering potatoes so much as ordering medium French fries. Kotak's analysis of McDonald's concludes, quote, "Nothing had names to match the source of their origins. I was no longer a consumer of food. Rather, I was a consumer of the ritual," unquote. This disconnect between food and creation does not only affect mankind's attitude toward the earth, but the very earth itself. Through the lenses of mechanized control that C.S. Lewis observed, agriculture is no longer perceived as, quote, "the art that tunes human culture to the needs and potential of soil, plant, and animal," unquote. Rather, it is turned into, quote, "an industrial force that erodes, exhausts, and poisons our world," unquote. It is for the sake of mechanized control that the soil is excessively tilled until it is reduced to barren terrain, that massive quantities of crops are planted in unsustainable plots of land, that these plants are then treated with heavy doses of chemical pesticide. It is for the sake of this industrial logic that livestock are crowded into dark, unsanitary feedlots, that they are pumped full of hormones to accelerate their growth rate, that they are treated in ways only imaginable within a distorted retelling of Noah's Ark, in which the kind and nature of the animals is disregarded in favor of man's will. The reason that people aren't disgusted by this attitude toward nature is because they have adopted the idea that they are most free when they are in control. As C.S. Lewis and other like-minded scholars have observed, we believe that nature is here not to shape us, but for us to shape it. As a result, we lose a sense of the created order. We forget that we are inherently connected to the dust of the earth, that there should be no disconnect between people and food and nature, that as long as modernity perpetuates this disconnect, both man and creation will suffer indefinitely. My second argument is that a modern conception of food exiles us from our own bodies. In his 1935 study, Techniques of the Body, French sociologist Marcel Mauss examined how the body acts as a canvas for wider social dynamics. In other words, how what occurs at a macro level in society also occurs at a micro level within the human person. This means that, in C.S. Lewis's terms, man's attempt to commodify nature, or in our case, to commodify food, translates into his attempt to do so with his own body. However, this comes at a great cost. Just as food becomes disconnected from its origin and grander context, so does the body become disconnected from the self. In her moving Pulitzer Prize-nominated memoir, Wasted, Maria Hornbacher recounts her 14-year struggle with anorexia and bulimia. She observes that eating disorders induce an inherent separation within the human person, that they cause the spirit to become violently divided from the flesh. It was this divide, this alienation she felt from her body, that caused her to ultimately turn against it. She says, quote, "The body, my body, was dangerous and silent. The body was silent, not to be spoken of. I did not trust it. I watched it with a wary eye," unquote. Of course, there are many factors involved in the development of an eating disorder, such as environment, personality, stress, and even genetics. But we cannot overlook that Hornbacher was able to experience this bodily alienation mainly because she lives in a society that treats both food and flesh as a commodity. Just as food can be altered and defined according to our wishes, so can the human body be altered and defined in whatever way the individual chooses for himself. This is such a radical departure from the biblical notion of the human body. In the Christian tradition, the human body suffers no disconnect, but acts as a mediator between the self and the community. And the way in which this relationship is ultimately consecrated is through food. It is no coincidence that Paul uses food imagery to describe the relationship between the individual and the community when he says in 1 Corinthians 10:17, "Because there is one loaf, we who are many are one body." Within this vision, there is no room for alienation, only room for love. Eating disorders, however, operate in complete contrast to Paul's vision of the body. They are characterized by secrecy, isolation, and a focus not on love, but on control. In her memoir, Hornbacher reflects upon the ultimately ironic nature of her attempt to control her body, saying, quote, "You believe, by definition, that your eating disorder cannot get out of control, because it is control. It is, you believe, your only means of control, so how could it possibly control you?" Unquote. C.S. Lewis had the answer to this question nearly 60 years previously, that in attempting to exploit nature, mankind actually ends up succumbing to nature, since it is simply ingrained within his sinful nature to rebel against God's created order, that despite our best efforts, we end up being controlled by the very thing we wish to control. And as long as humanity embraces this worldview, it will suffer exile, not just in macro terms, but in micro terms as well. Communities will be exiled from meaning, the body will be exiled from the community, and ultimately, the human person will be exiled from the body. My third argument is that a modern conception of food exiles us from biblical ethics. Today, we are living in the midst of what has been called a diet culture. Even movements such as veganism, paleo, and the so-called clean eating movement, which market themselves as lifestyles, fail to distance themselves from traditional dieting and fall right back into the same category as juice cleanses and detoxes. What all these diet practices have in common is restriction. The restriction of one's food intake, whether in quality or quantity, in order to free oneself from a life of sickness and be reborn as a happier, healthier human being. Over the past few decades, scholars have noticed how modern diet practices share striking similarities with classical religion. Diets essentially market themselves as saviors, which forgive people not of their wicked deeds, but of their sinful indulgences and guilty pleasures. They enact ethical codes for their followers, with strict distinctions between clean foods like spinach and kale and unclean foods like chips and soda. In her groundbreaking work, Purity and Danger, British anthropologist Mary Douglas argued that all societies contain purity codes, which allow them to maintain their identities. Interestingly, these purity codes are often evidenced in a society's notion of food. For example, Douglas noted that a main way in which the ancient Israelites maintained their Jewish identity was through dietary restriction and the careful regulation of what kinds of food entered their bodies. Douglas concluded that purity codes not only protect the essence of a culture, but also coherently define a moral standard of sacred versus defiled, of clean versus unclean. Through Douglas's model, we now see how modern dieting is a twisted counterfeit of the purity codes of the Israelites. It still defines what foods are clean and what foods are unclean in order to provide their participants with the means of achieving holiness. But as theologian David F. Wells has observed, modern dieting is characterized by, quote, confidence in self-mastery, the belief that the self can be reconstructed, that its aches and pains, its bewilderments, its confessions can all be healed with the right technique, unquote. In other words, we believe that through management and control, we can determine the outcome of our life circumstances, that through food purity, we can achieve holiness. But like the Judaizers of old, this fundamentally contradicts the Apostle Paul's message of what Alexander Schmemann called Eucharistic ethics. Paul was in opposition to many Christians' insistence upon dietary restrictions and exhorted believers to adopt a vision of the world that reverses the fall. Unlike Adam and Eve, who failed to trust in God for their needs, Christians are to have faith in his promises and provisions. In contrast to Adam and Eve, who ate of something for which they could not give thanks, Christians are to receive all food and drink with glory to God as creator and sustainer. Hence, Eucharistic ethics inherently involve thanksgiving, with 1 Corinthians 10:31 imploring, "Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God." It is through this manner of eating that Paul constructs a distinctively Christian ethic that seeks to foster a life of faith and trust expressed through thanksgiving. However, this ethic has been forgotten today. Foods for which God should be glorified are shunned as impure and unclean. Modern fad diets replace Christian liberty with strict taboo codes, and it is the keeping of those codes, not the grace of the cross, that allow one to achieve holiness. In this way, our modern eating habits reflect the purity codes of the Judaizers, who failed to receive all food and drink with thanksgiving to God. And as long as we fail to make the connection between ethics and thanksgiving, our eating will pull us back into a conception of the world where no Savior ever came and where the fall was never redeemed. Therefore, on the basis of disconnect from creation, alienation from the body, and distortion of biblical ethics, I have concluded that the modern world has exiled mankind from a Christian conception of food. Now, some may respond to my thesis by saying that I'm overlooking all the benefits brought about by the Industrial Revolution, that were it not for the innovation of the 19th century, we would not have the technology to produce and distribute food on such a mass scale. And certainly, I have no problem admitting that the scientific progress of the 19th century was a great blessing. However, what should have been a beautiful servant was turned into an ugly master. Mankind took its knowledge of science and technology and used it to completely redefine food in ways contrary to creation. And even if this does provide food for more people, at what cost does it do so? The cost is switching the roles of servant and master, turning that which is beautiful into that which is ugly. In other words, distorting God's created order. Others may be concerned with my condemnation of the restriction found within modern dieting. They may point out that this aspect of controlling one's food intake actually has roots in the Christian tradition, specifically in Christian monasteries, where, in accordance with the monastic tradition, Christian monks maintain very restrictive diets throughout the year. In this case, I would make a clear distinction between the fasting found in modern dieting and the fasting found within monasteries. The fasting found within modern diets is dominating and controlling. It seeks to micromanage every aspect of one's food intake so as to achieve a narrow human goal. However, monastic fasting involves submissiveness and humility. Rather than seeking to dominate and command, it is meant to empty and surrender the person to something completely outside of this world. Whereas diets today are characterized by control, Christian fasting is characterized by love. But this love is missing in the modern world's understanding of food, even though the very act of eating is supposed to be an affirmation of God's love for us. Now, humanity is disconnected from creation, at odds with the body, and imprisoned by a false ethical system. However, not all hope is lost. We have not been condemned to a world of exile, a world where Eve is forever lifting the forbidden fruit to her lips and where there is no possibility of redemption. What Christianity does is offer us a vision of food in which every time we eat, we receive an invitation back to the garden. Every time we join hands in worship, we stand together as guests in our Father's house, clothed with wedding garments, ready to partake of the banquet. And every time we break the bread and distribute the cup, we fulfill the command that reverses the fall, that redeems the world from death, and that restores mankind to paradise. Take, eat. Thank you.